Hello, welcome to the December 2012 edition of the Science and its Storm Center's monthly threat update. My name is Johannes Ulrich, today here in Jacksonville, Florida, and this will be about the last monthly threat update for 2012. So I mix it up a little bit and have a couple different topics today. Now, first I want to acknowledge our sponsor, Core Security. Core Security, as in prior months, is sponsoring this particular webcast. So I mix it up a little bit, have a couple of smaller topics today versus one big one. We of course start out as usual with Microsoft patches, just summarizing what they had yesterday from Microsoft. Then I'll talk a little bit about mobile malware. That's certainly something that this year has been sort of a hot topic, and talk a little bit about what we have there. SSH scans and Joomla exploits. Now, that's nothing specifically new, but I'll talk a little bit about why they're sort of increasing over the last couple of months or years. It's something that keeps on getting worse, not better. And then a sort of special topic I throw in there because it came up last month, and that's transparent proxies and in general sort of the security or insecurity of hotel internet connections, not just Wi-Fi connections, but hotel or public internet connections in general. So let's talk about the Microsoft patches. This is the summary. We do have a total of 7 patches that came out yesterday, 5 of which were rated critical by Microsoft, and 2 were rated important. A lot of this is actually sort of ongoing issues that we keep having with Microsoft software. And the first one, well, hardly a month without Internet Explorer sort of patch that comes out. Now, as usual, these Internet Explorer patches are cumulative, so it does include prior patches that came out in months past. 3 different vulnerabilities are being patched in this particular bulletin. The interesting part is it only appears to affect Internet Explorer 9 and 10, so the 2 most recent versions of Internet Explorer. Prior versions of Internet Explorer are not affected by these particular vulnerabilities. From a mitigation point of view, well, patching. Now, that's the real mitigation here. And I mentioned that you should expedite it just because the Internet Explorer is such a big target. But regardless, Microsoft recommends always that you should set the security level to high for all sites. That works great as long as you don't need any scripting and such. So I don't really think it's realistic to expect that from your average browser. Next one is again something we had at least the last 3 months, and this time it's a critical one again, kernel mode driver vulnerabilities. Sometimes they're only rated as important by Microsoft because they're not directly remotely exploitable. They're really more an escalation of privilege vulnerability. In this case, we are back to open type, true type vulnerabilities. Again, it keeps coming back. It's the same thing over and over. The open type and true type drivers are used to render fonts, and of course, websites, for example, can load their own fonts, and of course, one of these fonts could be malicious, and that's why Microsoft rates this as critical. There's usually no user interaction required in order to load a font. Can also happen in normal Office documents, so you open an Office document and it will load the malicious font. Again, no great workaround here. It is a feature that's really part of Internet Explorer and your Office software and such to be able to load fonts. The one thing that Microsoft recommends is to turn off WebDAV, the client part. That will prevent this particular vulnerability from being exploited via WebDAV shares. If you don't need WebDAV, it's certainly a feature that you do want to turn off, but be careful. SharePoint and such may need it, so don't turn it off without first really checking that you don't need it. And then we have Word vulnerability. Now, this vulnerability is so far special that Word vulnerabilities are usually rated as important by Microsoft. This one is rated as critical. The problem here is that you don't actually have to open the document. Just previewing the document in Outlook, for example, can trigger this particular vulnerability and lead to exploitation. So this makes this particular vulnerability worse than others. And I think it's really sort of a little bit the joker vulnerability here in this particular set. I'm not really sure how severe it will be, but it certainly has a lot of potential. Workaround here again, and I think that's a somewhat realistic workaround to read your email as plain text. I think that works actually quite well and does prevent a lot of other exploits, privacy issues and such with sort of images that are being included to track reading of email. So email as plain text, I think, is certainly something you should consider. Again, you know, be careful. We never know what people are using email for. Then we have a vulnerability in the Microsoft Exchange server, so more email-related issues. Well, this particular vulnerability affects Outlook Web Access, and it's yet another library where we keep seeing exploits against the Oracle Outside In library. Now, there was a few months back a big patch for these libraries, but there are a lot of other software tools that do include these libraries, and Outlook or Web Access or Microsoft Exchange Server is one of these tools, and this essentially is just patching the issues in this Oracle Outside In library. I would think that this is, again, no, really quite tricky. The purpose of these outside-in libraries is that they convert file types. Now, the reason Exchange and Outlook Web Access uses them is so via Outlook Web Access, you can read various types of files, like your PDFs, your Word documents, whatnot else, and essentially the outside-in libraries will convert these documents for you. But if there is a malicious document sent, then of course you expose yourself to these vulnerabilities on the Exchange server. So the victim here would be the Exchange server. The Exchange server would be exploited, not necessarily the person reading that email. The person reading the email would just trigger the vulnerability. The overall effect is a little bit limited here. The libraries run as the local service account, so that's a less privileged account, does not have access to any network resource and such. So you can be okay in this case. It's not like, you know, a complete sort of admin exploit off your Exchange server, but still, of course, that's just another step to escalate privileges once you're able to execute a code on the server. There's a second vulnerability here with RSS feeds, but that's just a denial of service vulnerability. So the vulnerability that makes this bulletin critical is the outside-in library vulnerability. And then we have a Windows file handling vulnerability. Now, this one I haven't seen an exploit for yet, but I think this will be quite an interesting exploit. Essentially, the way this vulnerability is triggered by exposing the system to an unusual file name. So what I expect here is either an overly large file name or file names with zero characters and other odd byte values as part of the file name that would probably confuse Windows about the length of the file name and then lead to exploitation. Now, how would you exploit this? Of course, you have to get the user to open a directory that includes the exploit file. Microsoft suggests a number of ways to do that. WebDAV again would work here. Of course, any other network share would work. You could even exploit this via email. For example, if you sent the victim an email with attachments, that once the attachment is expanded, do create those files. So there are a number of different ways how this could be exploited. It sounds really easy to exploit once the nature of this file name vulnerability is known. And like I said, at this point, I haven't seen yet what the exact issue is with the file names. And well, if you see it, let me know. Then you have MS-12082 Direct Play. Now, this is again sort of our more standard client vulnerability. Microsoft only rates it as important because it does require you to actually open the document. Be rated as critical on the client because, again, the opening document is not really a meaningful barrier here. On the server, it doesn't really sort of apply theoretically unless you open documents on the server with Office or Internet Explorer. So the way this would be exploited is with an Office document that you open in Internet Explorer. The tricky part with this particular vulnerability is that if you have a new system that only used Internet Explorer 8 and later, I believe, then Direct Play is disabled by default. So you have to actually enable it, which sort of puts yet another barrier to actually getting exploited here. But if you had an old version of Internet Explorer on your system, and the old version of Internet Explorer did have Direct Play enabled by default, and you opened in the past a document with Direct Play in this old version of Internet Explorer, then after you upgrade to a new version of Internet Explorer, that doesn't change, and then you don't need to confirm it. So it's only if you had the old version of Internet Explorer installed and you had a Direct Play document legitimately open in the past, then you may still be vulnerable even with a new version of Internet Explorer. So it's a little bit trickier to figure out whether or not you are vulnerable without user interaction. You're always vulnerable after the user actually allows Direct Play to start. And that's possible in all versions of Internet Explorer. And then the IP HTTPS certificate bypass, that's only important. It's really just a security feature bypass, they call it. You could kind of call it, I guess, approach escalation, but that's not really what it is. Now, first of all, about this IP HTTPS. IP HTTPS allows you to tunnel IP, so Internet Protocol, over HTTPS. Now, why would you want to do that? The reason this is done here in this case is to be able to set up essentially SSL tunnels for various IP connections through NAT. So HTTP travels nicely across NAT. That's why it's sort of all encapsulated in HTTPS. And then the IP packet essentially is just encrypted using SSL, part of the HTTPS connection. One application that takes advantage of this protocol is Direct Access. If you remember, in Windows 7, there's this new feature where you're able to remotely access a workstation. And it uses IP HTTPS to not only encrypt the traffic, but also to do access control to authenticate the user connecting. And that's where the problem comes in here. If you connect via IP HTTPS to Direct Access, the client authenticates itself with a client certificate. That's all nice and good, and this kind of SSL client certificate validation is actually quite good. But in this case, the vulnerability was that Windows didn't check if the certificate was revoked. So an exploit scenario here is where user that used to work for your organization got laid off and you revoked the certificate to prevent access, but you did not delete the account. In this case, the user could still use their old certificate to log in because the revocation of the certificate will be ignored. And that's sort of the real problem here. So it's not something where some random person can just connect to you via direct access. They do have to have a certificate that was valid at some point, but then later got revoked. Yeah, the easy workaround here for the IP-HTTPS vulnerability is probably to delete users, not just to revoke their credentials. That's kind of best practice usually anyway. The reason it's not done sometimes is that you may still have documents and such owned by that user. You may not want to lose the ability to identify documents used by, owned by that user, so you keep them still alive, or you know, for example, email received by that user, you have to forward it to a replacement. So again, yeah, that's why people sometimes are a little bit hesitant to delete user accounts, but it's better to delete or lock user accounts instead of just deleting the credentials, whether or not this is HTTPS or a normal username and password. Well, here's sort of my recommended patch order. The Explorer one and the Word RTF one I consider the most likely here to be exploited. I'm not sure about the Windows file handling vulnerability. That one may become number one here if there's an exploit available, but I rated that a little bit lower at this point because we don't have an exploit yet. The kernel mode driver, there are so many vulnerabilities with two type fonts, so there is again, sort of a threshold trove of past exploits that exploits writer probably can refer to write an exploit for. That's why I rated that a little bit higher over the Windows file handling one. Directly, because it doesn't really affect anybody or everybody, I rated that lower. And then the IP HTTPS, you know, that's really only some very specific exploit scenarios, so that's why that's last. For servers, don't forget in particular the Windows file handling vulnerability. That is a little bit more a client vulnerability, but certainly exploitable on servers as well. Yeah, I just want to take a minute here to compare on how Microsoft did this year compared to last year. Overall, there isn't really a big shift. We did have exactly 100, and I think the reason I have 101 in parentheses, there was one out of the usual rhythm of patches, so a special patch that was released late in December 2011 that put the number up to 101 last year. This year we stuck with two digits, so 82 total bulletins here. But you know, overall, that's not a substantial shift. As I pointed out this time, we still have the same components turning out to be vulnerable over and over again. You know, kernel mode drivers with true type fonts. I'm not sure how many patches we have for this particular component. So in Explorer, well, browsers are fairly complex. I kind of see that. They have many, many different components. But in particular, the true type font libraries, I'm kind of disappointed that they keep coming back. Overall, this year, just like last year, what we actually found is that the Windows vulnerabilities tend to matter less in current exploits than some of the third-party software. And that's a trend we have seen for a couple of years now. And this year was particularly bad for Java. Of course, there were some high-profile vulnerabilities in Java that kind of helped with that. But so if you think about patching, don't forget Java and Flash. And of course, we did have a Flash update yesterday that you also need to apply. They easily rank up there with the Windows vulnerabilities. For the most part, when I talk to organizations about patching, the Windows patching turns out to be the easy stuff. You have your Windows Update Server and all these different tools that Microsoft provides to make patching of Windows software or Microsoft software relatively smooth. The third-party stuff is really still a little bit an open and the problem here, I'm not sure exactly where this is going. Windows 8 doesn't really fundamentally change anything here. We do have in OS 10, for example, with the App Store and some ideas that make patching off those applications a little bit easier and more organized. In particular, for enterprise stuff, they're pretty much left with some third-party solution that sort of manages patching for you. And it certainly can be done, but just not easy in particular, not easy to enumerate all of these third-party vulnerabilities. Yeah, overall, with Windows 8, it's supposed to be more secure, but it's really too new to figure out what can be done or cannot be done in Windows 8. Another problem that keeps coming up is that these newer operating systems do offer to software developers a number of tools to make their software harder to exploit, but developers don't always take advantage of those tools. So I hope over time they'll get rid of some of the legacy software and end up with more, with new software that's compiled with these protection mechanisms in mind. And the last bullets here, and we'll get to this back when we talk about mobile malware. A lot of the malware still doesn't use any exploit at all. It essentially just asks the user to install it. And that's where we talk about mobile malware developments. Everybody is talking about how desktops become less important, and it's now more about appliances and mobile devices and such. And that's certainly something we have seen last year when it comes to malware, that we do have a distinct shift to more mobile malware. Doesn't mean that your Windows users are home free yet. They still get exploited. But you're also quite likely to get hit with mobile malware. Now, mobile malware at this point, we haven't really heard a lot of reports about sort of drive-by exploits. And that's the exploits that hit us in Windows so badly. Essentially, all these Java and Flash vulnerabilities that you just go to the site that will automatically install the malware for you. There are certain vulnerabilities that make that possible in mobile devices, but haven't really seen a lot of exploitations of those vulnerabilities. For the most part, people willingly install malicious software on their mobile devices. Most of the time in Android, they go to a non-authorized, I guess the right word, Android store and download malware from it, sometimes from the official Google Play Store, but Google is pretty good in at least removing that software pretty quickly once it gets uncovered. iOS still has quite a significant advantage here. At this point, there is pretty much no actual exploitation of iOS devices. The most common iOS exploit we see at this point is mobile device iOS systems that got jailbroken, and then the attacker is just using the SSH default password that's usually available in iOS. So without jailbreaking, iOS is still pretty secure at this point. But it'll change in the future. It's hard to tell, but at this point, that's true. Now, what are some of these new developments we have in mobile malware? One important part is banking malware. And that's, of course, something we had huge issues with in the desktop world. One result of this was that some banks now implement two-factor authentication. Now, two-factor authentication comes in many different shapes and sizes. So, for example, we could have a hardware token that you're given by your bank, and that's usually safe when we talk about malware. Where you do have problems is soft tokens or one-time authentication that uses SMS messages. So in the SMS case, you would log in to your account, and then the bank would send a one-time password to you via SMS. Modern malware will intercept these SMS messages and then forward them to the attacker, or in other cases, the bank actually doesn't do two-factor authentication. but it notifies you if you, for example, add a new online payee or if you transfer money, and then the malware will just make sure that you don't see those messages. So this has certainly become a problem lately. We just had last week, sort of in Europe, piece of malware that went around and supposedly cost something like $30 million in damage. Not sure how right the number is, but you know, it certainly worked. It certainly did cause some damage. So how do these soft tokens work, and you know, what's some of the problems here? I'm not sure if anybody here is familiar with the Google Authenticator, but that's sort of a nice prototype and really shows how soft tokens usually work. And two-factor authentication tokens, for that matter, all pretty much do the same thing. But essentially what they do is the token itself contains a unique seed value. Then there is a counter added to that value. And I just wrote it as a plus. Essentially, we're talking about sort of an HMAC algorithm. So the counter is added, and then a hash is calculated. And then the last few digits of the hash become your one-time password. Problem with that is that once the seed is known, then of course anybody can replicate the particular token. You had this problem in the RSA breach about a year or so ago, where those seed values were stolen. Typically, the user has no idea what the seed value is. The exception here is probably Google Authenticator. With Google Authenticator, the way you usually set it up is that you get to scan a QR code with the Google Authenticator app. That QR code essentially includes the seed. And that's sort of one problem with that type of authenticator, that you could create as many authenticators as you want just by rescanning that barcode. So really what two-factor means in this case is not something you know, something you have. It's really more something you know and something you have, but you don't know what it is. This secret that's embedded in your soft token, you usually don't know what it is, but anybody could steal it and then, of course, just create more tokens like the one that you use. With the hardware tokens, of course, that's harder, it's more difficult to do. Most of these hardware tokens do have tampering protection that makes it difficult to open them up and to retrieve that secret. And you typically can tell that someone tampered with your token. With the soft tokens, you don't, and that's sort of the problem here. Now, you may ask, should I still bother with two-factor authentication? Or is it just too vulnerable to be useful? In my opinion, you should still bother with two-factor authentication. Of course, if you're really worried, then you should use the hardware tokens. But soft tokens, I think still have an important spot sort of in your security arsenal. They do make it quite a bit harder for people to actually exploit and guess the password. So there are a number of important attacks it protects you against. Let your users know what they're about, what the weaknesses are, that they are careful with their phone, and also that they don't use the soft token as an excuse to have a bad password. Two-factor doesn't mean just a token. Two-factor means token and password. And the password should still be reasonably secure. Other things I've seen with hard tokens is that users write their password on the token. So people really have to know what some of these vulnerabilities are when it comes to soft tokens. Anyway, so much about mobile malware and soft tokens. I guess that the biggest risk right now is users willingly installing the mobile malware. And the most common sort of packaging of mobile malware is where a popular game, a popular application is re-released under the same name and the malicious component is added to it. Anyway, let's talk about SSH scans. And I want to show you this graph first, because SSH scans is certainly nothing new here, but we have seen sort of a steady increase over the last years. This starts here at 2003 and basically goes till today. We do have some spikes in here on individual days, but overall, sort of, you know, we have roughly 5% of all the port scans we see with the Shield these days that are targeting SSH. In part, this is explained because SSH is one of the few services that people usually leave open. You do normally need SSH for remote admin of a lot of your Unix systems, so that's why it is a pretty common port to see exposed, even outside to the public. Now, to look into this a little bit more, we started a new collection effort where we collect the actual credentials that attackers use to log in to the SSH server. We currently support one particular SSH honeypot, Kippo, but a couple people wrote us in that they're working on scripts for other honeypots and such. The main reason why you would use this script over the normal DShield client is that it does log usernames and passwords, so it gives us a little bit more of an idea what passwords are used and what are sort of the trends here. We only support honeypots for this because we don't want your real credentials to be caught here. And a good SSH server should not log passwords anyway. And so this is really something just for honeypots, and like I said, Kippo is a real fun honeypot. It gives the attacker sort of a semi-realistic shell so you can actually see what they're trying to do. Now, what are some of the initial lessons learned here? First of all, it's all about simple passwords. But then there are some of the more persistent scans that use some passwords I would consider pretty sophisticated. I assume that some of these passwords, like this add passwords, is actually something that some of these SSH scanning tools change the password to or set up accounts with it. So that's probably why they're sort of in these common password lists and are being used. I don't think that's a password that you would find in most normal systems. Temp pass, yeah, something like this. I definitely have seen in systems where this is sort of used as an initial password until someone gets around to change it. And then I've seen a couple passwords that I think are more configuration problems of the scanning tool, like here this member one server. Not really sure what this is about and why this password is used. If anybody has any ideas, let me know. It's certainly interesting to see why people scan for this password. Now, with SSH scans to be so common, aside from helping us collect these logs, something you may want to consider is switch to key-based authentication. This is very important. I have seen it where software that you install on Unix servers sometimes sets up its own accounts with weak passwords. Most notably, a few years back, I ran into some antivirus software that set up an account called Virus without a password, and I still see quite a bit of scans actually for that particular account. So disabling password authentication is certainly the way to go, even if you think you can enforce strong password policy. Then, of course, if you do have to allow passwords, audit the passwords, make sure there are no accounts with no or with weak passwords. I found it's quite helpful to run SSH on a non-standard port. Now, we frequently say that obscurity is not security, and this is certainly sort of security through obscurity, but while it's not perfect security, it helps. So it certainly helps to have your honeypot listening on port 22 and then have some other random port for the actual SSH server. And then overall, slowing down the attack. So you may want to, for example, implement lockout policies or slow down login attempts. That makes it a lot harder for the attacker, in particular if they're looking for some of the more odd passwords to try a lot of different passwords. Fail to ban is sort of a tool that can be used as an add-on for Unix servers, and this works for other services, not just for XH, so that's a tool that you can use there. But I find that the IP addresses in some of these scans change quite a lot. And if you have a botnet scanning you, then you may see each IP address only a couple of times. You can also do it on the firewall by just rate limiting new connections. So these are some of the things that you can look at to protect yourself against SSH brute forcing. And then you have another common exploit I just want to mention here briefly. Sorry. But that's Joomla. Now, Joomla is one of those PHP-based content management systems. Has always been a big target, but you have seen more of a focus on Joomla last month. So if you run Joomla, definitely make sure that you are patched. There are basically daily exploits you can expect against your Joomla install. A lot of it appears to use Google to first find, or Bing, actually I've seen a couple of cases, to find vulnerable sites. So if you don't run Joomla, you may not see a lot of these scans, but once you set it up, you will certainly see the scans come in after you're indexed. One of the problems with Joomla appears to be the extensions that come with Joomla. Joomla itself is a pretty bare bones kind of content management system, but then there are lots of extensions for photo albums, for calendars, and all of this. So that's usually what's being targeted. And probably the most important thing you can do is limit the number of extensions that you do install. Once they exploit you, what they usually try to do is that upload a fake antivirus to your site, and then visitors to your site are being asked to install it. So the big problem with Joomla is itself is difficult to patch, in particular if you have plugins installed. Sometimes, for example, you patch Joomla, but then your plugins break because they're not ready yet for the new version. And then some of the plugins themselves are vulnerable, and there's no sort of great process to really keep them all up to date. And some of the plugins, like they are no longer really maintained, so they may have vulnerabilities and nobody is fixing them. Mitigation, limit what you have installed. There are actually, and now I'm recommending you to install another plugin, but there are plugins available that will send you an alert whenever one of the plugins that you have is vulnerable. So that's certainly something good to have. And then definitely try to look at web application firewall rules for Joomla if you need it, or look into some other software to do it. But there isn't really any sort of great competitor. This is kind of why it is so popular. There are a couple other similar systems, but they're not necessarily much more secure. Anyway, one thing I'm doing a lot is traveling, and with that, I have to connect to hotel networks. Now, just a couple weeks ago, this issue with transparent proxies came up. This was one particular hotel where the transparent proxy was not only filtering the traffic, but it was actually modifying the content of web pages. In particular, this hotel inserted its own ads instead of the ads that you would usually see on the web page. There are actually some commercial systems that you can purchase that do just that, and they're frequently used sort of by free public Wi-Fi networks. Now, the reason this uses a transparent proxy is that the user that connects the network is really not aware of the proxy, which also means the user doesn't have to adjust any configuration. In many sort of enterprise networks where you use a proxy, you specifically configure a proxy. That's in so far better because now the browser is aware that everything it sends goes through a proxy. It uses the connect method for outbound connections and not just a get or post. With transparent proxy, the browser has no idea what's happening. And what's happening here? The way these transparent proxies are usually implemented, there are lots of different versions of it. but it typically starts out with a firewall. The firewall will intercept traffic to certain ports, like port 80, and then rewrite the IP header. It will now rewrite the IP header to point the packet to the proxy. So your browser establishes an outbound connection. It looks up the IP address for Google, for example, tries to connect to Google. The firewall will intercept that connection and replace the IP address for Google with the proxy's IP address. Essentially NAT, but NAT sort of on the outbound end and on the destination of the IP of the IP header. Okay, so the proxy receives that packet. The proxy now doesn't know what IP address you originally tried to connect to. The only hint the proxy has as to what site you try to connect to is the host header. And the assumption here is that once the server now does the IP address lookup on the host, it will connect to the same IP address that the client initially tried to connect to. But that's where stuff kind of sometimes goes bad. It's a really simple trick to figure out that you are behind a transparent proxy. Essentially, the IP address you connect to doesn't matter. So you could telnet netcat to a random IP address, and then you send a little HTTP request, what I printed here, just to get, and then as hostname, use isc.sans.edu. So the IP address you used is not the IP address for isc.sans.edu. If you still get a response back from isc.sans.edu, then you know that you're behind the transparent proxy, because the transparent proxy rewrote the IP header, and the IP address that you used didn't really matter. If you don't have talent or such, you could, for example, add a bogus entry to your host file, you know, just a bogus IP address for Google, and then connect to Google. Your browser will use your host file. It would connect to the bogus address, but the proxy, again, will rewrite it. Now, what are some of the problems? Of course, in this particular hotel, the problem was they were messing with the traffic. That's not what a lot of hotels do, but certainly not something to be concerned about. But there is another issue with transparent proxies, and that's same origin policy. Your browser usually maintains something called same origin policy, and it applies to a number of technologies like JavaScript, like in some ways Flash. For example, in JavaScript, if JavaScript triggers a request to a host, if the host is the same as the host that delivered a JavaScript, then JavaScript can do a lot more than if it would connect to another host. Now, where this becomes a particular issue is Flash. Let's say I'm connecting to a website, and I download an HTML page that includes a Flash applet. My browser will send another HTTP request requesting the cross-domain XML file, which tells us what kind of requests we can send to that site. Of course, both of these requests, the request for the original page and the request for cross-domain XML, will go to the same site, which we assume is evil. That site now gives us permission to connect whatever way we want. So next, the Flash script is setting up a raw socket connection, not an HTTP connection, to that site, to port 80, and then as part of the content of that connection, it sets a host header with the actual host name that it tries to attack. As far as the browser is concerned, you're good, because you're connecting to the evil site, but the firewall and the transparent proxy will rewrite that request to go to the innocent site, so this can then be used to bypass this cross-domain policy in Flash. What can you do about it? As a user, not much. You can try and avoid transparent proxies. For example, whenever possible, whenever you're connected to an untrusted network, you should always use a VPN to connect back to a trusted network. Try to use SSL for websites. Of course, that will verify the host name relationship. That helps, but you may not have a choice. If you are in charge of web applications, check the host header that you get back from the client to make sure it matches what you accept. So try to avoid these default hosts that get any request, and then support SSL help the user here. Anyway, we are at 45, so got it exactly right here. Any questions? And just while people type, a small announcement. We do have the daily podcast. The daily podcast will probably not run next week. I'll be traveling quite a bit next week, so probably won't get won't have sufficient internet connectivity. So if you don't get daily podcast next week, don't be too surprised. Maybe I get one or two episodes in. Anyway, I don't see anybody typing, so thanks for listening. Again, here are the URLs. If you have any other feedback or if you're listening to the recording of this webcast or handlers@sans.edu. Thanks for listening, and please consider submitting SSH logs or just your firewall logs to the Shield.